Hello again, everyone. This is Ron Ott with today's look at sports. Here's a letter. Twitter's favorite neck-bearded field general says goodbye. It starts, dearest friends, I hope this letter finds you all well. Life on the family farm is just as I remembered. I have been up at the crack of dawn each day, sometimes crowing before the rooster. Oh, how he hates to be beaten. The hogs are so happy to see me, they barely contain themselves in the pen. Dearest mother is in tremendous spirits. She was elated for my final return all in one piece. She insists I pass along her well wishes and assures you she fully intends to keep the unit stock with batches of squirrel oil for your upcoming battles. Oh, the times we've had out on our campaigns through the years, I feel as though I was just a youth who hardly had two neck beard whiskers to rub together when I first unholstered my sidearm. How we all have grown, one hard-fought battle after another. From that frozen tundra to face the horned barbarians, I recall sleeping in a deer carcass to keep warm, to combating those painted pirate ruffians in their land without light. And then there were the steel men, the battle in pit, and who could forget the orange horsemen? Good things we packed extra air since their land had so little. Of course, we were hoodwinked by the deserters, McDaniels, but that was serendipitous, as it led to an appointment of the esteemed General Reich. We broke hardtack and subsequently teeth together, shared mother's homemade goodies, each with spiced raccoon knuckles and sugared skunk thighs, as we stared up at the sky, imagining what it would be like to once and for all reach the great Bull Valley. I, of course, plan on following your move into the future, starting with your first battle against the Lightning Men in that formidable land, San Diego, or actually San Diego. I will be first in line as soon as the papers are off the press with the latest news of your engagements. And I hope I get letters from time to time informing me of your adventures. And finally, I would be remiss if I did not tell you, serving along each and every one of you is a joy and an honor. We lost battles, we won battles, but we did it all together, one mighty unit. While true, I shall not be on the field with you physically. Henceforth, my spirit will be always to take form of a colt. And it will be with you as you hopefully make your triumphant march to Bull Valley. Allow me to leave you with this. Never have I been such talent, courage, and seen determination in the eyes of those around me. My resolve was strong because my belief in my unit's abilities were unwavering. You soldiers, your unit is greater than the sum of its parts. Each of you has a fearlessness, heart, and grit to make a difference on the field. Yet the group working as one wins the battle. Please take care of yourselves and one another. Andrew. That's a sayonara from a long-standing Twitter, someone who's active. Next, analytics and foolishness have achieved what collusion could not disturb or destruct of baseball's fundamental labor covenant, whereby teams controlled athletes early in their careers and awarded their best with big contracts once they hit free agency. Organizations now appreciate it's usually a bad gamble to bet huge sums of future performance of players over 30. Suddenly an athlete like Adam Jones can't land more than a one-year deal for $3 million, no matter the decade of great service he gave to Baltimore. So even as Major League Baseball's annual revenues sailed north to $10 billion, total payroll has declined this year. Emboldened by their success of damming up free agency, the owners have pressed their advantage in multiple forms and on multiple fronts. Teams persuaded 30 players, including Mike Trout, to sign contract extensions this week, spring, and forego a collective 77 years of free agency. Some franchises frequently manipulate the service time of prospects. Others tank without consequence. The bottom line, if you take the percentage of Major League Baseball revenue teams paid players just 3 years ago, before baseball's current labor deal, and apply it to the amount clubs are likely to rake in the season, you get a number around $5.4 billion. That's a whopping $390 million more than the major leaguers are actually earning. But if the horse is out of the barn about veteran free agents, the players' own union was holding the door. The Major League Players Association signed it onto a luxury tax without even tying it to thresholds to league revenues, effectively creating a salary cap that barely budges. Well, the means the richest teams are going to set the top of the market for players by getting into bank-breaking free agency bidding wars anymore. Just look at what the Yankees and the Dodgers did to the past two winters. Now that management is unleashed, the numbers say there's one way that Major League Baseball players can claw back even a fraction of the power and the money they were bleeding out to owners. They must remember that a union has to stand up for its marginal members, its lowest paid, not just the superstars. Major League Baseball's minimum salary is $550,000 a year and will rise by nothing more than the cost of living adjustments reflected in afterthought status of the CBA discussions. But consider what would happen if that number were doubled or tripled. For one thing, young players would earn more money in their initial seasons. Then, through contract extensions and arbitration, one or the other, or ultimately free agency, because they would be starting their climb from a higher floor. The Yankees couldn't renew Aaron Judge's at $684,300 this year if the league minimum were $1.5 million. For another, teams would have to think harder about releasing major leaguers or leaving free agents in limbo as the price raises for their substitutes. They'd be choosing between Tim Beckham or Brad Boxberger or Clay Buchholz and bringing up a scrub who would cost them more than $1 million. This is very hard to screw up, even for the Major League Baseball Players Association, which has had its pockets picked in the past two CBA negotiations. The minimum flat salary is a flat number, not susceptible to fine print or ownership manipulation. You make a roster, and you get paid. There's potential political upsides, too. Owners have already rejected recent union proposals to reform service time rules, change the Major League draft so teams can't pile up high picks and add the DH to the National League. But management has agreed to a higher minimum salaries in the past and hasn't blown off incorporating the idea in future agreements. And maybe helping players whom fans don't already see as multimillionaires wouldn't trigger quite as much public ire as the financial complaints from the athletes usually generate. And finally, a minimum high salary for players would effectively set a minimum payroll for teams, and that would benefit all of us. Franchises like the Marlins and the Pirates don't just depress salaries by refusing to bid on players. They also dump their young stars in trades and collect revenue-sharing payments, too. Raising minimum salaries, letting pay ripple upward, and making it harder to field a AAA squad on a major league field would jolt these deadbeats. In today's environment, every new dollar that goes to players instead of owners is a small step toward restoring some sorely needed balance in baseball's economy and putting better teams on the field for fans to enjoy. Well, let them eat crab cake. Here's the old portion of the show for cooking. Crab cakes and cream spinach. This is at Arthur Ashe Stadium. The cost is $29 for the crab and $15 for the spinach. The calories, 400 crab, 250 in the spinach. It's spinach, Ron. After Benjamin Paluvicaj, an Albanian from Montenegro, immigrated to New York in 2000, he waited tables as a way to pay for college. Now he oversees a 6-restaurant empire, as well as a new pop-up location and the Champions Grill at the U.S. Open. The Novak Djokovic fans dishes on his game, planning for flushing a Grand Slam. Why serve seafood at a sporting event? Well, crab cakes are a classic American dish. They're easy to prepare, easy to eat, and fans love them. Why is spinach a sought-after side? We don't use cream in our spinach like most restaurants. Our chef makes stew beforehand and uses the broth with the spinach. Your crab cakes bring the heat, Worcestershire sauce, and Tabasco. People like a kick, a jumbo lump crab meat, a little spice, and some lemon juice, and you got a deal. So, with that in mind, maybe you could use the side of a drink. How about the Honey Deuce, which is 1.5 parts Grey Goose vodka, 2 parts fresh lemonade, 1/2 part raspberry liqueur, and 3 honey melon balls for garnish. Chill in a Collins glass by placing it in the refrigerator or freezer by filling it with cold water for 5 minutes. When the glass is sufficiently chilled, fill it with ice, measure and add the Grey Goose vodka, and then top off with fresh lemonade. Measure and add the raspberry liqueur. Stir, garnish with a skewer of 3 frozen honeydew melon balls, and you got the drink. And by the way, to prepare melon balls, please place honeydew melons in the freezer until firm, and then use a melon baller to scoop out the fruit. Sounds like a good combination. This is the sports world in 2019. Last week, fans from an Italian soccer team, Lazio, were captured on video marching through the streets of Glasgow making Nazi salutes before a Europa League game against the Celtic. Weeks earlier, Bulgarian supporters made the same gestures in the stands while hurling racially abusive language at England's players at the Euro 2020 qualifier in Sofia. The Italian soccer league has been plagued by fans yelling racist slurs at players all season. One club, Cagliari, has seen several instances in recent years but has faced no serious punishment from the Italian soccer authorities. The apparent rise of corrosive fan behavior isn't just happening in soccer or outside the United States either. There were several prominent incidents involving NBA fans who showed little respect for boundaries last season, instances in which, such as DeMarcus Cousins or Russell Westbrook or Kyle Lowry, were subjected to racial taunts and physical contact. After discussions with the players, the NBA has toughened its code of contact for fans this season. installing a zero-tolerance policy for abusive behavior. But as soccer has shown, instituting a policy doesn't mean much if it isn't enforced. This year, FIFA established a three-step procedure to address biased fan behavior. The first step involves the referee stopping the game, followed by a stadium announcer requesting that the behavior stop. If it doesn't, the referee may suspend the game and send the players off the pitch whilst the stadium hears another warning. If the abuse continues, the referee has the authority to abandon the game altogether. The new policy has been followed in some cases. In a French league game in August, the referee halted play to stop homophobic chants coming from the stands. But the three-step procedure hasn't been enforced uniformly in Italy, where bad behavior occurs regularly. What should Italian soccer authorities do? What should they be doing? For starters, they should do more to identify individuals, name them publicly, and prevent them from attending games. Also, instead of letting teams with serial offenders like Cagliari skate without serious punishment, they should be beyond issuing fines and hit clubs with points deductions in the standings. Respected Napoli coach Carlo Ancelotti has said he has pulled his team off the field if his players were subjected to racist abuse, and it's hard to believe that Ancelotti and Napoli would be punished for what they did. The World French Cup winner, Lilian Thuram, who played Italy and has devoted his post-playing career to fighting racism in soccer, says too much responsibility rests on the targets of the racial abuse across the action. He wants to see white teammates speak out forcefully against racist behavior. But that doesn't happen, or nearly enough. When Juventus forward Moise Keane was racially abused in Cagliari last season, his own teammate, Leonardo Bonucci, said Kern deserved part of the blame for celebrating his goal in front of the opposing fans. After Inter Milan's Romelu Lukaku was subjected to monkey noises at Cagliari's this season, one of Inter's supporters groups wrote Kakalu a letter saying he should consider it a sign of respect. Closer to home, fans of a Mexican national team have for years been chanting in Spanish a word that FIFA has deemed homophobic when opposing team takes goal kicks. FIFA has fined the Mexican Federation 14 times in response, reportedly a total of $190,000, but has never taken more serious action, and so the chant has persisted. In September, U.S. soccer authorities were ready to invoke FIFA's three-step process during a friendly against Mexico and New Jersey, but the U.S. didn't take enough traditional long goal kicks to draw the chant. It remains to be seen how efficient the protocol would be, or if referees will have the guts to abandon a match. The same could be said for the NBA in its new policy, which forbids not just racist, sexist, and homophobic abuse, but by denigrating language from fans that isn't basketball-related. The league says it will pull a fan out of a seat and investigate if an incident arises. The NBA certainly did practice that kind of accountability this season. The Celtics banned a fan for 2 years for his language towards Cousins, and the Jazz banned two fans for life for yelling racist insults at Westbrook's Warriors minor owner. Mark Stevens just was fined $500,000 and banned for a season for shoving the Raptors' Lowry from his courtside seat during an NBA Finals game. Basic civility is becoming a bigger issue every day. It's admirable that the NBA is taking stand against toxic fan behavior. The soccer world would be wise to pay attention. What about those two women that exposed their breasts behind home plate during the World Series? They're banned for life. After a tweak sparked a crisis, the NBA must weigh the cost of playing ball with authoritarian China for a piece of their market. In June of 1973, more than 2 years after the U.S. table tennis team helped the Nixon administration open diplomatic ties to China, another delegation of American athletes was dispatched on a similar mission. At the invitation of the State Department, two teams of men's and women's college basketball players spent the month barnstorming the People's Republic, which rolled out a red carpet of dinners and receptions and fan events for its honored Hoopster guests. Even Zhang Qing, the wife of Chairman Mao, made a surprise appearance at an exhibition game in Beijing. "It was a splendid scene, friendship," wrote SI's William Johnson, who accompanied the party, with the small, dignified First Lady reaching up and up and up to grasp the hands of smiling young giants from America. That was the sell, anyway. From ping pong diplomacy to the 2008 Summer Olympics to its upcoming gig as host of the 2022 Winter Games, China has long use sports to foster a positive image with non-communist government-friendly competition as a reflection of open-mindedness. It is a small tactic, if only because Western pundits tend to be suckers for the storylines that sports can bridge geopolitical divides. Which brings us to Daryl Morey with a 7-word message for support for protesters in Hong Kong who object to China's growing control over the island. The Rockets GM wound up kindling an international firestorm. It didn't matter that his tweet of October the 4th was swiftly deleted, and the NBA issued an apology to deeply offended many of our friends and fans in China. It didn't even matter that Twitter is inaccessible in China. When today's more than dozen Chinese companies have suspended ties with the league, Rockets merchandise has vanished from the country's major e-commerce sites, and broadcast magnate Tencent has announced plans to stop broadcasting Houston games. Even the Chinese Basketball Association, currently helmed by Rockets legend Yao Ming, couldn't spirit away fast enough, canceling G League exhibition games scheduled to take place later this month. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver can extol the possibilities of basketball diplomacy all he wants. But this episode has proved that the league is simply the latest in a long line of businesses to find itself paying a high price for tapping into the world's second largest economy, ruled by an authoritarian regime. Then again, the NBA already ignored morality in the 2016 opening of the training center at Xinjiang, the region where an established 1 million Uyghur Muslims are being interned in camp. Over a 4-day span in August, the CEO of Cathay Pacific Airways was apparently forced to resign because some employees participated in the Hong Kong protest, and fashion designer Donatella Versace penned a mea culpa after her company released a T-shirt identifying Macau and Taiwan as independent companies. Gap, Marriott, Delta, Zara, and others had to make public apologies for similar offenses regarding Chinese territorialism in 2018. The main audience for this isn't even the NBA. It's future American companies who want to do business there, says Isaac Stone Fish, a senior fellow at the Asian Society Center in U.S.-China relations. There's a Chinese expression, kill the chicken to scare the monkey. This is Beijing saying, hey, look at what will happen if an employee writes something in support of Hong Kong. But the playbook for market rehabilitation isn't hard to follow, as the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman outlined in a recent news conference. The MBA has been in cooperation with China for many years. Knows clearly its heart and to say what to do. That begins with apologies and self-censorship. Certain companies will go through this gauntlet, and the lesson they'll learn is to tie themselves closer to what the Communist Party wants and needs, and they'll see their business improve as a result of this strategy over the long term. It's fairly craven, but that's what happens. By the time the Nets and the Lakers flew home after staging a pair of exhibition games in Shanghai and Shenzhen, though, the public furor had largely simmered. Chinese state-run media had been cutting back on stories about the Mori incident, fearful that continued attention could hurt its image in the sporting world, according to the New York Times. It was a sign that Beijing was blinking, as well as a reminder that the NBA held leverage, too. China may threaten to restrict economic access to its 1.4 billion residents, but how would its estimated 500 million basketball fans, if state figures are to believe, stomach, say, the entire season without being able to see LeBron James or Steph Curry or television of the games? Inevitably, everybody who interacts with China runs into Chinese sensitivity, says Scott Kennedy, an expert on China's economics at the Center for Strategy and International Studies. It's just that here you got these two behemothic, one world's largest, fastest-growing economy and one of the world's most successful global business, whose stars can use their platforms to speak their minds. With more apologies for offending Chinese fans, more silence about third rail issues, more commitment to inoffensive concepts like friendships through sports, the NBA is likely to find a middle ground with the Middle Kingdom. At what cost? Well, the league has prided itself as a progressive defender of free speech, but someday it actually puts its money where its mouth claimed to be. I can't wait to go home and tell my wife, kill the chicken to scare the monkey. That's it in sports for today. I'm Ron Ott.